Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
I would like to introduce to our two amazing, wonderful, lovely speakers. So today we have Becca and Sarah Ray. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm so excited for this one. And thank you so much for taking the time. I know it takes a lot of behind the scenes work, but also obviously being here today. So thank you so much.
Yeah, our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
If you just want to introduce yourselves, explain a bit where you come from and why you're here, that'd be great.
Okay, so I'm Sarah. I'm a trans woman. And I come from a small town in rural Illinois, and I'll tell more of this story in a little bit. But essentially, I moved down to Florida in my 20s, 30s. I don't know how old I was, and was finally able to sort of address the issues of my gender identity struggles and gender dysphoria. I am a director, co-founding director of the Atheist Community of Polk County here in Florida. I am a humanist celebrant. I recently joined the board of the Humanist Society. I am on the American Atheist State Legislative Action Team for this 2021 legislative session. I produce and host a podcast called Free Thought in Florida, which is part of the Atheist Community of Polk County, that you can get on YouTube and Facebook Live and all of those things. I am a newly minted and trained RFR support group leader. We haven't gotten started yet, but I'm all done with my training and I'm excited to get that going. And just maybe the last piece of that is the place I live now is a very conservative, rural, sort of red-leaning area. And there just wasn't anything here. And that's really what led us to create the nonprofit and really get more involved, because there weren't any support options for secular folks here. Becca.
Hi, I'm Becca. I'm Sarah's wife. 10 years now? Something like that?
Yeah.
I grew up in South Florida. I'm a native Floridian, which is rare. I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness. I left in my early 20s and moved here to Central Florida, co-founder and director of the Atheist Community of Polk County. I am also assistant state director for American Atheists, and my life right now revolves around our two young children. So school teacher.
Right.
All the things.
Science
teacher,
ELA.
Yeah.
Yeah, the joys of quarantining whilst also having to take care of children. I can't imagine, honestly. I salute you. Would never do it.
It's insane.
Yeah. So you mentioned that, Becca specifically, you mentioned that you grew up in a small town. I guess the first obvious question is just, how was your experience growing up in such a small town? I am going to assume with a lot of religious influence also.
So you said Becca, but Sarah's the one that grew up in a small town. So
I meant Sarah. I totally meant Sarah.
Good.
Let me describe for you the small Midwest town that I grew up in. Bethany, Illinois is a town of about 1,400 people. I had a graduating high school class of 32. I went to kindergarten with the kids that I graduated high school with. I went to kindergarten with, right? We've known each other our whole lives, is the kind of place this is. Mm. There are no chain stores or restaurants. There are now. They got a Subway. Woo, that was big stuff, right? They got a Subway. but we had no chain restaurants or stores. We had a little locally owned grocery store, you know, which was closed on Sunday. Everything shut down at, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. If you think of a small Midwest town, that's what this place is, right? We had our downtown was like two blocks, right? And we had some locally little small restaurants, and there was a video arcade. But this place had, there were no stoplights. and 9 churches. And the joke that I tell when I when I do this in is part of a presentation that I do when I tell people about this church, there's 9 churches in a small town. There's actually one of them that's, I think it's still for sale if you're interested in owning a church in Midwest small town. You can certainly do that. It's been a number of things. It was a church when I was a kid, and then it was like a bed and breakfast for a while, and then it was like an antique knickknack shop. So now it's like, it's listed as like a 9-bedroom home with an attached sanctuary. Like, it's great.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
I really want to ask like our budget person. We do have a budget for it, because how epic would that be?
Oh, that'd be amazing. So great. So good.
I think you need a retreat location in the middle of nowhere.
I don't go there. No. it was a nice place, right? But it has all of the trappings of small town Midwest America, right? Yes, there were 9 churches. Everybody went to church. I didn't know a single non-religious person, and I didn't know a single non-Christian person. There were, I like to describe it as like cornfields and soybean fields and white people, just as far as you can see. There was no diversity, you know, and this was like late 90s that I graduated high school in 97. And, you know, gay was still a hushed 4-letter word in this place, right? Like, you just didn't, it wasn't something that you talked about out loud, and people weren't out about it. So imagine then me being, I was around puberty when I really started, you know, to feel different about my gender, and then trying to, you know, deal with all of that in a place like that, was really interesting.
Interesting is the key word there, I guess.
Yeah.
No, that must have been really difficult, because obviously small towns in America are known for being conservative and not very like open-minded. I may be wrong, but that's just like the stereotype. So that must have been like really complicated to grow up in such an environment.
That was definitely my experience. It was very insular. You know, outsiders were sort of feared, and that's, you know, whether that was geographical outsiders or people from other countries coming in to take your jobs and all that kind of crazy nonsense. I heard it all. And, you know, that was just that it was part of our culture. And I think, not to go down this rabbit hole, but I think that's an interesting thing that I reflect on now when I look at the divide in our country. There really are 2 Americas. There is an urban-rural divide that doesn't get addressed as often as maybe we should address it. But anyway, that's not what we're here for.
that's a completely different that. Rx.
Yep.
Yeah. And Becca, how was it for you to grow up in the Jehovah's Witnesses and just, you know, in the environment that you grew up with?
Well, there was, in the early years, I didn't really think anything of it. I just, my mom and dad told me this is what it was, and that's what it was. The real kicker for me was always that we converted, and none of our extended family were witnesses. So when I was like 8 years old, when my family started going to the Kingdom Hall, and it was huge because my grandmother was very disapproving. And so there was like a 6-month period where I never saw my grandmother. And prior to that, she was like, we were best buddies. I was the first grandchild. She had all boys. I was a girl. So we were like always together. And then I was 8 and it was just like cut off for 6 months. And then it was never really the same. Like, it took a long time to heal that relationship. And then when I started growing up is when I really started to kind of the cognitive dissonance had to set in at some point, I think, because I was working outside of the cult. I had a job and I was interacting with people that weren't witnesses. And I was like, okay, this something wasn't, it just wasn't connecting anymore. So it just was normal up until that point when I started realizing that, no, something's wrong here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
What's interesting, I think, about our different backgrounds is, and I'm looking too at some of these poll answers, a lot of people being taught strict gender roles. So despite coming from like small town conservative uptight Midwest, the church that we went to as a kid was very much like, I call it vanilla Christian. It was a First Christian church. And, you know, we went to Sunday school, and Sunday school was all about, you know, learning some songs and sticking some stickers in a workbook. And then, but, you know, and like church was just sit quietly and listen to the service, and then stand and sing when it was time to stand and sing. And then you sat quietly until it was time to stand and sing again. And then when I left there, I mean, that was just, you know, it not quite Presbyterian, but close. Mm-hmm. And when I left there, I went to a Church of God, and that was like culture shock, you know, hand in the air screaming, praise Jesus. And, but so it was just different that I, like, when I think about my childhood, I don't think about my religion having that much influence on me. It's not a conscious thing that I recognized. I've had to break it down and sort of think back through, you know, what some of those influences might have been. I don't remember being taught overt, strict, like, gender roles or stereotypes. I don't remember being taught it.
Yeah.
Right. It was there.
Yeah.
But I don't remember it being a...
I think Jehovah's Witnesses are known for their extreme views. Mm-hmm. So I had a much different experience. There were people in our congregations that we like whisper. We knew, oh, so-and-so's gay. And they were allowed to, and it was explained to me as a child, like, or well, a young teenager, I guess, preteen, that they're allowed to be gay. They just can't act on it, much like what the Mormons are saying now. And I just always thought that's so weird. Like, why would you? I just couldn't connect. Why would you sit in a room if you couldn't just be yourself? But because there were always those private conversations in whispered tones, and you just kind of, as a kid growing up, I had oodles of self-esteem issues. Like, I was never, ever myself, and like, I don't know. I always like, I'm maybe just could see it more clearly when I was looking at somebody else than myself. Mm-hmm. And always just felt really bad for those people because they're living this huge lie. And then, you know, in hindsight, it's like, wow, okay, that I was just doing the same thing in a different flavor, maybe.
Mm-hmm. When I reflect back on, you know, all of this, I really think of these lives of mine being in like separate and distinct buckets. Uh-huh. I lived them separately. I started a Bible study group at my school when I was in like junior high and was leading it. Went out and bought one of them fancy, you know, NIV youth study Bibles. And we were meeting at lunchtime and doing Bible study. I had written some sermons and was allowed to present them at my local church, a couple of them. And so there was this, in one life, on track to, like, I thought I was called. I was going into the ministry. This was a part of my life. This was a place I was going. And then meanwhile, in a completely separate part of my life that really didn't intersect with my religious life, puberty was happening and I was starting to feel different. And not so much different, like, I mean, everybody feels weird and different during puberty, right? But I was getting feelings of like, whoa, something is really wrong here. This is not supposed to be developing this way. And I became obsessed with thoughts of my gender. Like, why wasn't I a girl? I feel like I should be. What the hell happened? I can tell you of countless nights that I laid in bed thinking, I just want to wake up tomorrow and be who I'm supposed to be. It was never a prayer. I never prayed for it. It was never like those two pieces of my identity just did not touch back then at all.
Yeah.
Which I think is really strange. And it's just an interesting, I don't know, maybe that's a trauma response.
It could be. It really could be.
So the way that all was handled, my parents took me to a therapist who, and again, I was, you know, young teenager, took me to a therapist who very clearly, well, to me, very clearly did not have the expertise to handle a situation like this. You know, I did what a lot of trans people do as they're sort of, you know, first discovering and exploring. You know, I would take clothes from my mom and sisters, and then I'd get caught. And my parents, you know, my mom would just grill me, why are you doing this? And I didn't have the language for it, right? Remember, we're talking in the mid-90s when jokes on the Jerry Springer show, that's what trans people, we didn't have trans people. We had, you know, cross-dressers, and I didn't know my wife was a man kind of BS on Jerry Springer.
Yeah. Dad, I wanted to ask you that. Did you receive any sort of education at all about what it is to be trans? You know, what it means? Because I feel like there is... Okay, I can see it.
No. No, back then, no. But I do remember it. So, like, I'm a Xennial, right? So I grew up with the internet, right? I had the old dial. I grew up with, as the internet evolved, I was growing up. And so I was on the front lines of that generation that got into message boards and that early connectivity. And I can remember finding crossdressers.com, and I was probably 18 or 19 at that point. And I identified as a crossdresser for a long time just because we didn't have any other language for it. I knew that's what I did, and that sort of fit for a while. And then I found that online community of people who, holy crap, I'm not the only person that feels like this. Maybe I'm not a freak. Maybe I'm not a weirdo, right? Or at least maybe I'm not alone. And so that was huge for my being able to, you know, address these things. But, you know, so we tried to go to therapy and that didn't work. And then, and I can just remember the therapist asking over and over and over again, why do you do this? Why are you doing these things? Why are you taking this stuff? And I didn't have the language. That just did not exist then. And so, no, I mean, when I was a teenager, I didn't have any of that language and didn't start learning any of it until I was, you know, I moved out on my own, 19, 20 years old, was, you know, working in radio and living again, separate lives, living this double life where I would come home and present as my female self, and no one knew, and I kept it all hidden, and there was a lot of shame attached to that too. And I don't know how much of that is from like the reaction that my parents had when they discovered that I was exploring these things. But I picked up real quick that, like, hey, this is not being embraced. This is not being celebrated. This is probably a thing you shouldn't let anybody else in on. And so I hid it for a long, long, long time.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to accept being trans as part of yourself, despite being in such a hostile environment for your gender?
So I was living in Decatur, Illinois, which is a an industry town, and Caterpillar, ADM, Staley's. The Firestone tires that you heard about blowing up in the early 2000s, that was us. That was our plant. But you know, it was a working town. A lot of blue-collar factory. And so still wasn't really safe, right? So, but I was at least at that point able to order stuff online. That was a thing I could do now, right? eBay was big.
Yay, internet.
The internet probably saved my life in a lot of respects. Because I was terrified to go shopping. That stuff, you get into your head and it's damn near impossible to get out. Like, even now, I need to have a shopping buddy.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
We have an entourage.
Thanks, shopping buddy. So anyway, I was working in radio. I had gotten married to my first wife, and she was aware that this was a thing. She was, what's the word? Not very supportive, but like she tolerated it. Yeah, that's it. And so it wasn't like it wasn't something that she embraced and supported. Mm-hmm. And eventually that, you know, that didn't help. That contributed to the drift. But we moved to Florida together and drifted apart and separated and got divorced. And then all throughout that time, though, I feel like it's important to mention the cycle. Mm-hmm. Talking about shopping. I had a chest that I stored all of my stuff in. All of my girl things were in this chest that I could literally box up, put up on a shelf, and forget about. And that I did that mentally too, right? That wasn't just a physical thing. And so I would go through these cycles of the guilt and the shame and why am I doing this? There must be something wrong. This is not right. You shouldn't be like this. What's wrong with you? Stop it. Right. Well, you don't just stop it. That's not a thing that that doesn't work. That's not a thing you can do. But boy, do we try over and over and over again. And so I would box all this stuff up and I would put it up on the shelf and or throw it away. That was the worst part. I've thrown away so much. It just makes me sick.
Don't feel too bad about it. You can't fit into any of it anymore. Anyway.
You're right. You're right. I didn't look good in any of it then either. and I would throw it all away and go be a man for a few months. And I would try my damnedest and put on the show. But then those feelings would come back and I would have to address it again. And that cycle just went on and on and on until finally we were married. I think I had gone through one of those put it away cycles for quite a while.
Yeah. It was like after we had our son.
Right.
You went through this. All right. I'm done. And
I got a kid now. I got to be the dad.
I got to be a dad. Yeah. That kind of thing. Yeah. I don't know that it lasted that long, but I remember because he was still a little baby when it was just very obvious. Okay. We've got to address this. We've got to figure out what's going on. And it was a few years of just me trying to be like supportive. If it makes you feel good to paint your nails and put on a dress, do it. And I think, you know, also for you finding other support outside of home, like she had friends that she would say, hey, let's go do a girl day and dress up and go shopping or to lunch or whatever. And so that was all very important. And it was a piece that wasn't there before necessarily.
This is the interesting part because we probably have different memories of how all these things went down because I have trauma brain that blocks out a lot of things. I have a really bad memory. But yeah, so coming down here to the Orlando bubble, yes, we live in Polk County is a conservative rural area. But I worked at Disney for 12 years, almost 10 years.
Almost 10 years.
Almost 10 years I worked at Disney. And that's where we met. We worked together in Fantasyland.
I wasn't sure if I was allowed to ask how you met because I already knew the answer and I love the answer. I think it's the most thing
ever. Yes, we worked attractions, ran the rides in Fantasyland.
Oh, it was attractive.
Anyway, the Disney bubble, the Orlando blue dot.
It's a safe
place. It's a much safer place. I mean, it's entertainment. Is filled with queer people of all kinds.
Yeah.
And so I got down here and started seeing other people like living their lives and not giving a damn what anybody else thinks. And I think that, again, not consciously, but I think there was something in that was like, hey, this is a safe place. This is okay.
Yeah.
And then I started to talk to people about it, people that I work with that I figured out, you know, were probably safe and was able to really discuss like, this is who I am. This is the person you don't see at work.
Right. And it is different because people here are not like, oh, well, you better not tell anybody about that or they'll be going around church on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Like it was like, oh, cool. You're going to let's go out to the club this weekend or whatever. I mean, everybody's just got their own thing going on, but everybody's so supportive of the community. Like the community here is just really, really good.
So that was, you know, had I known I was coming for that, you know, it's one of those things where when I was a religious person, I would have thought, oh, God led me here because I needed to be with my people, you know. But, you know, the fates aligned and I'm thankful because I often think about like, had I stayed back home and there are people I went to school with this is one of those places where like multi-generation families run the same farm that great, great, great grandpappy ran. Like it's, you know, that's just people don't leave. So a lot of the people I went to school with are still there. And I often think to myself, like, wow, I'm glad I've left. Yeah. And I don't go back. I go back for weddings and funerals. And even that's pushing it.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it came to a point where I decided, okay, this is not just something that I do. This is who I am. Mm-hmm. And I need to do something about this. And so I went to therapy. There is a, and sadly, all the big, you know, LGBTQ therapists are in Orlando, which is an hour drive from where we are. But I went, and side story about therapy. I told Daryl this story the last time I had him on our show. We went there, and this woman told us, we were talking about our problems with work.
We were miserable. We were in debt and jobs. It was rough. Everybody goes through this, right?
Yeah. And she said, well, listen, there is this documentary that I want y'all to watch that I think could be really helpful. It's called The Secret. Watching the reactions in the in the Zoom. Don't
we
do that.
We were foolhardy enough to go watch it, but we had a good laugh.
Putting stuff out into the universe, it'll come back. Don't do that.
I haven't seen it, and I really wanna know what it is.
Well, there's a movie now loosely based on that documentary that's like a fictional movie that I want to watch just because I want to laugh. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, I went to therapy alone. And this, you know, again, they specialize in LGBTQ mental health care. And so within the first appointment, a lot of trans people have to, you know, we jump through a lot of hoops.
You have to prove yourself.
Bullshit. God, it used to be in the old DSM, you had to live in the preferred gender for a year before they would even give you hormone replacement therapy and all of that. So we've come a little ways, but still, this place just dropped all those barriers and said, like, look, we can tell, you know, like, come on, we know. And so I went in and when we talked and the appointment, I didn't know about The Secret yet, but the appointment went well. And she said, you know, you are like textbook gender dysphoria. When would you like to start transition? And I was like, 15 years ago? Can we do that? And I was like, yes, let's do this. Then I came home and I told Becca what a great appointment I had at therapy.
Oh, you could see it.
And she was glowing. Ready to do this.
She was glowing. She was so happy. I could tell.
She was silent for about 24 hours.
And it killed me. Like, if that guttural, like, oh, this is really happening. Holy shit. Oh, crap. Like, and I don't even know why, but I was like, I had to just take that time to process.
Well, and you had had, friends when you were younger.
Yeah, no, this was nothing new to me. Like, I had friends that were Jehovah's Witnesses, and we would, like, I had this one friend, and I swear to this day that he's trans, and he just doesn't know it. But dress up for Halloween, and let me do your makeup. And, I mean, this guy was, like, 6'7", so you go anywhere dressed as a woman, you're going to stick out. But that was the only time he felt safe to do it. And so that's what we did 2 or 3 years in a row. So I was very familiar with this, like, urge to, you know, but the transition really scared me because I was like, oh my gosh, this is hormones. This is possible surgeries. This is literally life changing. And I just wasn't sure at that point how ready I was for that kind of change. Because I had lots of questions and lots of concerns, and there was just a lot of still unknown for me, I think. So we just kept going to therapy.
Yeah. So how did you work through that? Was it just going to therapy?
Yeah. Like I have to see how all the pieces fit together, and I have to know what my role is and where my place is. And my biggest concern was, is she going to go through all of this and then not want to be with me anymore? When you have a kid, that's kind of like one of those things where it's just like, I can't do this on my own. And if it all falls apart, what's going to happen? And I think for me, once I had all those answers, I think the thing that really drove it home for me was at one point she said to me, listen, you and our child are my priority. So if you can't deal with this, if you can't handle it, then I won't do it. And I could see the change. Like she went from this super happy, glowing person to just dead. Like, and I went, no, nope. Even if it falls apart, if she's whole and happy and living her authentic life, at least that's what's best for our child. So well, fortunately, it's worked out. But
we haven't told the story in a really long time.
I know. Are you going to cry? Oh, don't cry. I'm holding it together. If you lose it, I'm gone.
So when we went to therapy together, this is my memory. When we went to therapy together, there was a question of like, how does this work for me? Like, what do I get out of this? I'm attracted to men. Yeah. I'm not attracted. How is this going to work?
Uh-huh.
And I think it's interesting how that's evolved.
At that point, I don't think I hadn't really come to terms with where I was belief-wise. So there was a lot of contradictions going on inside of my brain and my heart. And so when you think about, okay, I grew up in this very ultra-conservative religion and homosexuality is wrong. And at that point, I didn't really agree with that. But there's still these things in your brain that you don't even realize are there until you're confronted with it. And so there was a lot of questioning going on there. And I don't really think I had even at that point come to terms with what my sexuality might have even been, because I didn't really ever go through that. I never confronted, like, am I straight? Am I bi? Am I lesbian? Am I pan? Am I, you know, there's so many different things that I could have identified as, but I was just told you have to be straight. And so that's what I've been my whole life. And so there's an interesting, thing that I think if you push yourself, once you get out of religion, you might explore your gender and your sexual attraction differently if you can get outside of your head, because I hadn't even done that yet at that point. So it was very weird.
That was going to be my next question for you, was how much of what I was going through got filtered through that worldview that you had been put into.
Well, yeah, probably most of it. You know, there was it because I didn't have anything else to really filter it through. Like, there was a lot of contradictions going on inside of me, because it was like, well, I love this person, but you know, ultimately you have to do what is right for you. And I don't think that my beliefs were ever going to jeopardize what my decisions would have been. But I will say my mother is still an active Jehovah's Witness. And when I finally did tell her what was going on, oh my God, did I get an earful? So, you know, like it's one of those things where I had to make sure that I knew how to defend myself, defend my family, defend Sarah, because I, at any moment, I don't know when she's going to just, you know, give me some kind of lip about something, but I have to be prepared for that. So in order to be prepared for her and her weird accusations, I have to really examine like what those beliefs are, so that I can come back with, well, okay, but here's a counter argument to that. So,
well, let's talk about our families for a minute, because interestingly, I think, you know, when I went through this process and started, I changed all the things, right? I legally changed my name, gender marker. I started presenting, and with that comes like some insecurity that I wasn't used to carrying around in public.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was fast.
Yeah.
It was really fast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but I had 30 years of being comfortable in the male role, you know, while it wasn't comfortable, like, it was comfortable enough that I could go into a Target and go to the restroom and not even think about it, you know? So there were things like that. And since that therapy appointment where we went together and broke that all down and came to the thing she said about, did you fall in love with the penis or the person was a big thing.
Yeah, like, that's huge.
Since that moment, like, then you were there propping me up when I needed it. And that translates into our family really well because, so I had been telling people at work, this is what was going to, you know, at this point I was finally, I'm going to do this. And I was transferring around a lot at Disney at that time too. So it was new teams often. And then I left the Disney corporate side and went to Disney's government. And they didn't have a policy in place, which was odd, where Disney does, the Reedy Creek didn't. So, you know, having to deal with all of that. But throughout all of this, like coming out over and over and over again to people, I had to figure out how is this new employer going to process me transitioning on the job? They've never done it before. They don't have any policies in place. What's that going to be like? The people that I had talked to, I had started cutting out people, you know, from my life, just people that I could tell weren't going to be supportive when it came to light.
You know.
Yeah, you can tell. And surrounding myself with those people that I was pretty sure I could trust. And then I, you know, was slowly coming out to them. But I had prepared myself to lose everyone, including Becca, because I know that's a possibility. I see the news stories. And again, those are the monsters in your mind that you know, that you build up. And not every experience is like that, of course. But thankfully, mine wasn't. But I had prepared for my family to turn their back on me, for all of my friends to walk away, for like to really have to start over. My mother sort of maybe had a light bulb moment, right? Of like, oh, well, that's what was going on with you all those years ago. I wish I had known, right? Like that was sort of, that's the mother's
That's mom's response,
thing, right? And then my dad was like, okay, but you know, he factory man his whole life. Like, okay, but how are you going to hold a job? That was his, you know, his focus. I have two sisters that are 11 and 12 years older than I am. And one of them, who is married to a pastor, said, that's just not something that we believe in. We're going to have to agree to disagree. And the other sister said, you'll always be my brother and I'll always love you, which was kind of a side-handed, but okay, right? Fun story, fast forward months later. The sister that's married to the preacher reached out to me and said, hey, so there's this kid at our church and they're moving and they're trans. And I don't know what to do for them. And I was like, oh, thank you for calling me. I'm so happy you called me. So she and I have gotten a whole lot more closer through all of this, which has been interesting too. But so my family was, you know, largely supportive, I guess.
Yeah.
And have gotten more and more used to it over time.
It's taken time. I think, and the biggest part of that is that they live so far away. Her parents come down once a year. And the first couple of times it was really rough.
With the dead naming.
With the dead naming and the misgendering. And our son was on it. He was like, it's Sarah and it's she.
Yeah. When he was like, what, five or six?
He was like five or six. He was, it was like, he was
great.
I love that child.
Yeah.
I mean, I love both of my children, but he was just amazing. He was my little hero. And so it took some adjusting. My mom was probably the hardest one and still will be. One of the caveats to me being on board with Sarah taking hormones was, okay, fine, but before you start hormones, I want another baby. So we
and I said, okay, come on.
Let's go. We had our daughter. Our daughter was born. I said, go get your drugs. But before that, I remember being like about to pop pregnant, and my mom came up. She lives like 4 hours away. She came up for the weekend to help me get nursery furniture, and she was just, oh, I want to look at a townhouse. I want to move close to my grandbabies, and then. Told this guy at this place they're building townhouses And we stopped to look in. She needed a 3-bedroom townhouse. And I was like, why do you need 3 bedrooms? You're one person. Well, you know, because when your marriage falls apart, you're going to need a place to stay.
Wow.
Like, I'm literally pregnant, about to probably go into labor any minute now, and you're going to start this fight. And so it was a long, drawn out conversation. And clearly it was just her ignorance about how gender and sexuality work, right, because she's just severely undereducated.
Well, the other favorite one was if he.
But yeah, it was all he and him and dead name. And I'm just like,
but if he gets the operation.
Yeah. But yeah, story. So she was like, well, is he going to get surgery? And I'm like, and we haven't even gotten there yet. She hasn't even started hormones yet. Kind of waiting for the baby to finish cooking. Get one fire at a time, right? Well, you know how men are. He's going to get a vagina and he's going to want to put a real dick in it. And I'm like, mother! I'm sorry if that was too much. But that's what she said to me. And I was just like, really?
And you were selling sex toys at the time, which was great.
I was at the time. I was like, I've got everything that she could possibly want. It's fine. So she's still very, very ignorant. I had to school her on what her own religion's doctrine and policies are for trans people, because she's constantly begging me to come back because Armageddon is happening. And I was like, well, even if I wanted to, I can't, because they'd make me divorce my spouse. And that's not true. And I'm like, oh, yes, it is. Go ask your elders what would happen if I said I wanted to go back. But I will not leave my trans wife. And she said she didn't need to ask them because she knew that I was full of crap. And I'm like, no, you should probably go ask. And then she just sidestep. Have you prayed about it? And that's the subject's change for her. And I went, yeah, we're done with this conversation.
But you had to set some clear boundaries with her.
Like,
yeah. And enforce them.
Very much. Well, she's a worse memory than Sarah. So boundaries really don't help much.
Well, and but maybe
it is. It's
maybe the last part of that is our kids. We sort of mentioned our son and how he responded to it. So he was young enough that
he knows
it was a change.
He remembers.
He had been calling me daddy.
Yep.
And for a time, I said, you know, because we sat him down. We've always talked to our kids like they're adults. Mm-hmm. We don't baby talk to them like this. We're going to tell you how it is, and you can handle it. And we're here for you. So we sat him down and explained, this is what's happening. This is a change. And for a time, it was, whatever you want to call me is fine. You want to call me daddy, you want to make up something else, whatever. Like, it's fine to me. Because at that moment, it was more about him than it was about me. It was, you know, he needed to take time to process it and figure out what this meant to his mm-hmm. little life. But then after some time, then it started sort of affecting me in ways that, like, you're in the middle of Target and somebody's daddy, and there's no daddy. And so then we had to come back and have another conversation. But again, it was explaining to him, like, this is how it makes her feel.
Yeah. And we never wanted him to feel like he was losing anything.
Right.
And so we had to give it to him in pieces that he could understand as he could understand it. And he's really, really smart. And so it was very easy for him to just transition into, okay, well, what do I call you? And we left it up to him, and he picked that. So, you know, it was always very easy, I think. And it just, that's just because kids are way smarter and more understanding than anybody gives them credit for.
Much more able to,
to
change.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. Yeah. They are more flexible at the end of the day. So that makes perfect sense. I just wanted to ask you, and it's kind of a 2-part question. So, if there's anyone watching who is either trans or just a general, not a general, like a member of the LGBTQ plus community, not necessarily just trans, do you have any tips in terms of coming out to their families? Because that can be really traumatic. So, and when I say coming out to their families, I mean both in like families that you expect to not go so well, for example, having a Jehovah's Witnesses mom, but also having a child. Do you have any tips on how to make that transition easier?
First and foremost, make sure that you're safe. You don't ever want to put yourself in a position where you've compromised your safety. Because even you just never really know. And it's unfortunate, but that would be that's the very first step, is always make sure that you're safe, or that you have a safe place to go or be in the event that things are not good.
Yeah, there's so many different variables to consider there. You know, like I think a lot of the advice we give people about coming out as non-religious applies to coming out as a different gender identity or sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. If you're a minor and you rely on your parents for your livelihood, maybe hold off on it if you can, you know, until you're out on your own and that kind of stuff. Try to surround yourself with people who are supportive, and every situation is different. Every person that you're coming out to is, you know, potentially different. But I had prepared to lose it all. Just in case. Yeah. And I'm glad that I didn't. But had that been the result, you know, I had done a lot of things mentally to be ready for that in the event that it did happen. And I was an adult living on my own, not relying on.
Yeah, it really is. It does come down to just making sure that you you're doing what's best for yourself. And even if what's best for yourself is coming out, that doesn't necessarily, that's not the end all be all. If you can't survive the situation you're in, if the people that are taking care of you are not supportive, or the people that are living with you are not supportive, or whatever it is, if you're sustaining yourself, then you're in a better situation. So maybe if it's not safe yet, that's your next goal, is to just work towards sustaining yourself.
I think about with our kids, a lot of it was about, you know, getting buy-in. Mm-hmm. I don't need you to accept this, but I want you to.
Right.
And so, you know, it's about transparency and honesty and trust. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with our son, it was giving him a lot of time and space to, you know, figure it out on his own. Not that he really needed much.
No, he didn't.
But
which is really amazing that obviously your son was so open to it and so accepting. I can only imagine then that in other families that is maybe not the case, and that it can cause more struggles. And when you said that you are really prepared to lose everyone in your life, I feel like you say it almost very casually, but it really does have such a deep meaning and such a like a harsh reality of what it is like to be trans in this day and age, and you know, 20 years ago or how many years ago it was. But I can't imagine how difficult that was.
When you think about like all of the there's a good word that I'm not coming up with, all of the things that you have, that you, the hoops that you have to jump through, the roadblocks that have been put up in place. You know, we think about things like being able to access therapy, quality therapy, being able to change the gender marker and name on your driver's license, social security, and your passport. And in a lot of those things, it's a patchwork of laws across the country. And so where you live makes a difference. And so like for me, in order to change the gender marker on my birth certificate in Illinois, they require that you have surgery first, which is dumb. But in Florida, they don't. Well, Florida doesn't manage my vital records, despite the fact that I'm a resident here now. Mm-hmm. I have to go back to my state of birth to get my vital records updated and deal with their laws. And I'm not a constituent there anymore, so I can't do anything to change their stupid rules because I don't live there anymore.
Like, so stupid.
When you think about all of these dumb little things that just I call them dumb little things, but they're not. But and you pile them all up on top of dealing with all of the stress and what's my family going to say and are my friends going to say all of that stuff.
And I just want to go on a Disney cruise. So we just need her freaking passport updated.
Yes.
Well, that's, I don't know, it's so heartbreaking to hear, because obviously it's not just your own struggles and your own psychological, like it's just the world against you. Like, what you say just sounds like a bureaucratic nightmare, like even more so than your average bureaucratic nightmare, which is sort of horrible. But
I think the bow that ties all of this together really is that so much of this opposition to gender nonconforming people comes from the religious community. You know, North Carolina House Bill 2 is when that really was like a flashpoint for me, where I had stopped caring about religion. I was apathetic to it all. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter to me. It didn't affect my life.
We never even had that conversation.
No, we didn't.
Like we never spoke about it ever until that.
And then I transitioned.
Yep. And it was like, boom, and boom. They passed, it was like bombs going off everywhere. And I'm like, shit, this is bad.
They passed that bill that would require me in the state of North Carolina to use the men's room, regardless of what I look like, because of what's on my birth certificate. And then Texas tried to do one of their own. And it was just the dominoes started falling. And that's when I entered my angry atheist phase, because here we are, religion screwing over my people.
She was so mad.
I got to do something.
Yeah. It was bad. It was.
And how does religion affect your lives like nowadays? Because I'm assuming you are not in the angry atheist phase anymore.
No. I want to say I didn't stay with that too long.
It was like two episodes of her podcast.
Only two?
No. It was like a flare. Like anytime something would happen, she'd go on a rant.
Yeah. Get it
out of her system. And that was her therapy, really. Like, because I have to tell everybody about this, and then it was okay. You know, and I mean,
but at some point it led me into political activism and organizing and all of those things where, you know, we need to respond to these bills when they're filed. And prior to the Project Blitz came out, and it was 3 years before all the national organizations got together and signed a letter to say, hey, we don't like that.
Yeah.
3 years.
Shouldn't have been 3 years.
And so there hasn't been really good organized opposition to the Christian nationalist legislation waves that we've been seeing.
Why we're in the boat we're in now.
And so finally we're there. Like finally we've got some organization around it, and you know, there is some response. But also it moved me at some point. I moved into, maybe this was organizing, creating our local nonprofit, moved me beyond the angry atheist phase into humanism, right? I became one of those people that's like, what good is atheism without, like, on its own, for its own sake, what good is atheism? I don't believe in God. Next, moving on. Who cares? What do we do with that? And what we do with that is humanism. And that's, you know, again, we're advocating for minority rights and all of the actual religious freedom when it's used properly. And so a lot of that activism is tied to humanism. And then, you know, we started doing like homeless outreach and food insecurity programs and like really engaging at home and making a difference in people's lives. And that's been a therapy for me too, I think.
Yeah.
That is really, really nice. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. We're kind of running out of time. So thank you so, so much to both of you. It was such a lovely presentation, interview, conversation. I learned so much. I do have like a couple of friends who are trans, but none of them have transitioned, and all of them are either my age or younger. So they don't have the perspective of someone that, you know, already has children. So that was really, really valuable. So thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm also sure that this is really, really encouraging to anyone who's listening, who is trans or part of the LGBTQ+ community. So thank you so much. That was really nice. So without further ado, we're going to go to a Q&A. So the first question that we got submitted is, what is the difference between suppressed persons who stay in their oppressive town and those who leave? Is there a difference that some people have, like a trait that leavers are born with, or are they just motivated by outside stimuli, in your opinion?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it depends on your circumstance. I mean, I was oppressed where I was, so I left the situation I was in. I don't know that it has anything to do with
I know there may be an underlying biological, neurological thing, but
I mean, you do have people that are more assertive. Like, you know, you have your go-getters and you have your people who like to just wait around until they get something handed to them. But I don't know. I think when you're in a situation where you have to leave, it's fight or flight. That's what happened with me. That's why I left home. And I think Sarah just wanted to go work at Disney World.
Sorry, I was looking for a book. I have a book called Predisposed, and it talks about it talks about, like, from an evolutionary biological stance of, you know, it's more about, like, your political leanings. Mm. That we are predisposed to be either, you know, liberal or conservative in some ways. And I think there's a lot of, I'm sure that plays into a lot of, you know, whether I'm going to stay in my, you know, my safe, small, conservative, you know, bubble, or whether I'm going to get out and go see the world. And a lot of times, once you go out and see the world, like, it, there's an instinctual response. It's either, oh shit, I need to go back where it's safe, or, ooh, I love it out here.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure that that's, I'm sure there's an evolutionary trait that carries. Not an evolutionary biologist.
No, me neither. Sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, no, that answer works perfect. Thank you. A more practical question is, what advice should we ask our politicians, obviously in regards to trans policies and LGBTQ plus policies?
So a lot of the advocating that I've been doing lately, again, we just had the 2021 session come out. You may have seen there was a bill filed federally this week that would, like, require genital inspections for students playing sports at school, which is just nutty.
That's a nice way to put it, but okay.
Yeah, well, so there's a lot of it is just changing people's hearts and minds, but also that these old misconceptions that people have about what is a trans person, right? Yeah. A lot of people still have never met a trans person.
It's their worldview. You have to change their worldview.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, when they're unaffected by it, they just don't understand it. If they've never seen it, they don't know what it is. And so it's easy for them to out of sight, out of mind, and not care or understand how any of these things affect that particular community.
Mm-hmm. There are several bills in Florida that are going back into existing laws to add protections for gender identity and sexual orientation. And, like, for me, that's really the thing. It's a rights issue, right? So there's two ways to interpret the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And one is the textualist. These are the words that they wrote down, and that's what they meant. Period. Full stop. They didn't write gay people, and they didn't write trans people, so you don't get those rights. And then there's a view of it on the intent of the law, right? Which is to protect people who belong to a minority class from discrimination on the fact that they belong to that minority class, right? And so if our lawmakers are saying the former, then we need to go in and add gender identity and sexual orientation, I guess, because you can't, you know, you can't be humans about this. So we'll go change it. We'll put it in the law. We'll spell it out. That's what we need to do. And I think that's what we have to do, because we're seeing so much opposition to adding it, to protecting it. Or we'll protect it, but there is a religious exemption card that you can use so that your church doesn't have to follow that law, which is nuts too. But yeah, a lot of it is just, you know, updating language and making things more accessible for people. There's a language thing. This doesn't specifically tie into the GSRM community, but we have a bill that was filed here that I'm watching it would provide menstrual products in all of our public schools, which is stupid that we don't have that already. I was shocked to find out that, like, we're asking kids to buy their own stuff That seems like low-hanging fruit, no-brainer. Let's take care of these kids, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the law that they introduced is feminine hygiene products. And all the language is feminine hygiene products and girls' bathroom. And that leaves out the trans men who were born with the anatomy that's going to need those products, but they don't identify as either feminine. And they hopefully in safe schools, they're not going into girls' restroom. So I wrote the co-sponsors of that bill and said, hey, I love this. This is great. I'll get everybody I know behind this. But also let's change this language to say personal hygiene products or just hygiene products or menstrual products. Or there's a million different ways you can say that without gendering it. And then also you need to change the language of in the girls' restrooms to say single occupancy, non-gender restrooms has to be included in that. Mm-hmm. Maybe the nurse's office. Like there are some other things that we should be doing in addition to that. Yeah. So it's thinking about, and I think every group has gone through this whether it's, disability rights or whatever it is, that if you don't live that experience, you're not thinking about those things.
Right.
And so it's just bringing that awareness to, hey, this is the lived experience of people that you're not taking into consideration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's so much progress to be done in terms of policy. And I guess obviously including the language sort of world, but also just like practical things, like you said, just like providing menstrual, or like hygiene products and things like that, which are really not like considered at all. Like, a family member of mine, I'm not going to say who, but, was against, charities that help provide like free hygiene products, and I was like, why would you be against that? And they said that it's because there's more important things in the world to worry about. And I was like, what?
This idea that we can only work on one thing at a time is going to kill us.
There's millions of people on the earth. We can all have our own little thing to work on and we get it all done.
Yeah.
We could solve all the problems if everybody just worked on something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. So another question we have is, could you get a bit more into the details of how you explored these new gender and attraction paradigms? Paradigms? And the question follows up with a bit of a reflection of this person that says, I've always heard that book smarts don't translate to real world so easily, speaking about most things, I believe. I'm kind of curious if there are groups of people who help others explore these different perspectives, or alternatively, is a person supposed to just know their preferences via self-reflection alone?
So for my gender exploration, I'm trying to think of like all the different ways this manifested, but a lot of it was in appearance at first. It was a gender presentation more than anything. And the identity part of it really didn't, like, I didn't think about I don't know. It's just, it's you just are, right? It's not a thing that you think about. In the presentation piece of it, there was a lot of just mimicry, like, I was mimicking what I had seen that I thought was, normal or attractive for my sexuality. I have always been attracted to female identifying people. Through transition, though, it's funny because we had that conversation about like, how's this going to work for me? I have found whether this is a hormonal change or what, I don't know, but that I've become more attracted to the person than the parts. And, not that I'm, I can look at, and maybe it's a safety thing too. I don't know. Cause I didn't ever think about male identified people in a way like that.
Talk about when you look at your old pictures.
Oh man, that guy was hot.
Right?
Okay. I hated it.
But when she was in that body, she hated the way she looked.
You're right.
And I'm sitting here going, babe, no, you're good.
I did.
But
I
now she thinks that he was hot.
Yeah. Yeah. When 6 years ago, me pops up in my Facebook memories. Whew, yeah, it's crazy.
It's
though.
So weird.
Yeah.
It is. It's funny.
Anyway, as far as like groups, there in the trans community, there are. I'm not a group person. I'm not much of a. For somebody who's leading groups, this is going to sound strange, but like, I don't like people. I'm not a group person. I don't like to, but and maybe it's just that I didn't feel like I never fit in. I never fit in anywhere.
I have a perspective on this.
Okay, I can't wait. But I never felt like I fit in anywhere. Whether that was like in school with my peer group, in my gender role, I have never. And so now there's a thing that a lot of trans people go through when they first transition, what we kind of call the second puberty, right? Like you finally, you're free to be yourself and you just go, you go crazy. And so that's why you'll see a lot of people who, you know, are maybe not dressing appropriate for their age, right? To you. But it's because they're like teenagers again, and they're finally getting to, you know, go crazy with the makeup and and dress and just explore and and be themselves. I didn't do that.
You did.
Well, I did.
It didn't last long. It was like maybe a month or two.
Yeah.
Like, and then it was like, oh, makeup is so stupid. It takes forever. And that was it.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, I expected it to last a lot longer, but it didn't.
So there are groups of people who will like, oh, let's all go to the cosmetic store and like get our makeup done and buy some stuff. And I'm just, that's not my drive.
She's never been like, hey, let's go out and do anything except for two different things. Like when she worked at Disney, there was a group that went to this place called the Adventurers Club.
Oh, yeah.
It's the best. It's closed now. It was the best. But it was like you go and you drink. And so
drinking. But I was never a bar person. I was never a club person.
No. But so drinking is a coping mechanism. And this place is like a comedy club / bar.
Right.
Perfect for a person who is not comfortable in their own skin because you can just drink and laugh. And then you go home and you get a call from the bar that they have your credit card.
That happened all the time.
But. She's right. She's not a people person and she never has been. But what I've noticed is since we've started our groups, she's becoming a people person. And I think it's because she's finally around people that she's comfortable with, that she can actually be herself around, that she, and I think it's the same, the Disney mentality, this club that she would go to was at Disney and it was a safe space. And while she was still presenting male, it was still a safe place to be. But I think with the groups now, she's a people person. She didn't know it.
But yes, on the point of like whether you just know your preferences or like how you figure that out. There are some groups of people who get together and go out and do those things. But I think a lot of us suffer in solitude.
It's
as we try to figure all of that stuff out. Yeah, because oftentimes you're doing it before you come out.
Yeah,
you know, just trying to.
Yeah, I think it is a symptom of that, though, the fear.
Yeah.
You just kind of keep to yourself because that's safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know people that have started businesses that are like specifically for trans people, like I'll go shopping with you.
Or for you.
Help you. Yeah, or for you or whatever. That kind of stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Thank you. Someone else was asking about your process of leaving religion, because I know obviously you have mentioned that it hasn't really been that significant as maybe for other people, but they were asking specifically whether was it the fundamental principles of religion that kind of put you off the religious doctrine, or was it more was the I guess the journey of realizing that you are part of the LGBTQ plus community that kind of made you, you know, separate yourself a bit from religion. And this question is for both, obviously.
So much of it for me was detached. Again, it was like two different worlds. When I left Illinois, so I had been going to this Church of God, and they got me playing in the praise band, and And the youth pastor that led the praise band was like, hey, if you're going to be up on the stage, like, we need to make sure that you're like living a godly life and stuff. So like, let's do some one-on-one Bible study. And so we did, we met every week, and he had me going through, reading and writing down the truths and the promises. And I just remember, like, the more I read, the less I believed, sort of thing. Like, a lot of people, like, when you crack the Bible open and actually read it, you're like, oh man, people believe this stuff. But it wasn't like that in your face for me. It was, they were expecting me to be someone who I wasn't. And that's a bridge to my identity with gender. Because I was still not living my authentic life. I was still pretending to be someone else. And so in this church, I was also pretending to be someone else. I was not this godly person that they thought I was supposed to be. And so I stopped going to church and Bible study. And I was like 20 or 21, something like that. And the funny part of that, I think, is how they pushed me away after that, because I stopped going. And what does a church do when you don't show up on Sunday? Call you. Hey, sure missed you on Sunday. Everything okay? Anything we can do for you? Well, sure hope we do see you next week. We sure do miss you. Right. And those phone calls would just come in week after week after week. And finally, I was just like, stop calling me. Like, I don't want to be there. I don't want to come back. And so I quit going. And then again, I was like an apatheist for a while. I didn't really care until, you know, and then we moved down here and I didn't. That was the last church I attended, was that Church of God.
Mm-hmm.
I just drifted away from it, really.
Yeah, that's basically what happened to me. I mean, I remember having a moment before I moved out. I was still living with my parents, which when you live with your parents and your parents are Jehovah's Witnesses, you have to go to Kingdom Hall. And I did all the good Jehovah's Witness things for a long time. But I was going through a lot of things that on the surface, nobody knew about. I was in an abusive relationship. I was having my own like doubts because that my prayers weren't getting answered. My parents' marriage was like basically non-existent, falling apart. But nobody wanted to admit it. There was just lots of trauma going on. And I remember going to the elders and telling them, I cannot do field service anymore. I had made a commitment to do 90 hours in field service as a pioneer, and I needed to back out of it, and they wouldn't let me. And they just told me to pray about it. And I'm like, I've been praying about it for months. It's not helping. And they basically told me, well, oh, well, if we let you stop pioneering, then Jehovah's blessings won't be on your family anymore. And I'm thinking to myself, the blessings are gone. Like, we are all falling apart. Nobody's happy. Everybody is like just in very toxic situations. And so I walked out of that meeting thinking to myself, I'm never going back in that building. And then it was a while like of dodging meetings, and I'd go hang out at my grandmother's house and hide there during meeting times. Fortunately, my parents were in a different congregation, so they didn't know that I wasn't going, but it did. It kind of just was one of those things where I just said, I'm just not going to go back. And I drifted away and I moved away and didn't really confront it again until around the time Sarah came out, because that was when I had to really dive deep so that I was prepared to have those difficult discussions with my mother.
Thank you for sharing that. That's, yeah, that's really, again, heartbreaking. Really, it must have been really, really difficult. And I am so, so sorry that you had to deal with that. I don't know much about Jehovah's Witnesses, but I do know that they're very close-minded and that they're very open to any sort of new anything. So I can only imagine how that experience must have been like. But yeah, thank you both so, so much for doing the session with us.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.